From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the Democratic Senator Joe Manchin just came out of a meeting and said he expected the government could be open in just a few minutes. Republicans and Democrats have been huddling all morning trying to end the three-day-old government shutdown. Last night, lawmakers came up with a compromise plan to fund the government until February 8th. And to win the vote of Democrats, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he intended a vote sometime soon on extending DACA, the Obama-era program that shields young immigrants from deportation. Here's McConnell on the Senate floor this morning.
All of us want to make life better for the American people. Bearing this in mind, I hope and intend that we can reach bipartisan solutions on issues such as military spending, immigration, and border security, and disaster relief before the February 8th deadline.
Ron Elving is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, I'm sure you're watching, too. We see on our TV screens the senators getting ready to take a vote. What's going on?
It appears at this point, Robin, that as Senator Manchin told our Scott Detrow of NPR a few minutes ago, the votes have been assembled on the Democratic side to create the 60-vote majority necessary to move this continuing resolution, and then the House will have to approve it. Speaker Ryan has said that along the lines of what he understood would be the deal in the Senate, he thought they could get a vote for that in the House. If that's true, then the green light could be on again, as you suggested a moment ago, by the end of this afternoon.
Well, what exactly did Mitch McConnell mean, though? Some are saying it depends on his definition of intent. It's not a promise or a pledge. And here's Maine's Republican Senator Susan Collins wishing that McConnell had been a little clearer in what he was promising. Let's listen.
First of all, I do think it would be helpful if the language were a little bit stronger because the level of tension is so high. But you have to remember that initially the majority leader was not talking about this issue. So he has moved.
So Ron, you know, what are Democrats saying about what they trust from Mr. McConnell?
Trust is too strong a word. I don't believe that the Democrats in the Senate really entirely trust Mitch McConnell, but they are hoping that the sheer visibility that this has all been given because of this brief shutdown, 2.5 days, will make it much more difficult for Mitch McConnell to bury this particular promise, as he has buried other promises to have votes on other issues in the past. So that's what they've accomplished, if they've accomplished much of anything.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of questions also about President Trump's role in all of this. ABC's George Stephanopoulos pressed White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders about that. Let's listen.
He's been incredibly engaged. He's been spent a lot of time on the phone discussing.
No meetings this weekend,
members.
Sarah.
He's had a lot of meetings internally with staff here at the White House, and they've been going back and forth with negotiations.
But, Ron, there's been a lot of reporting about hardline aides like Stephen Miller and even Chief of Staff General John Kelly have been swinging the president away from making a deal that has anything to do with immigration. Who is in charge here?
The president is a man of many conflicting impulses, and it is clear that the chief of staff, John Kelly, who came to that job, as you recall, from being secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, is someone who takes a rather astringent view of our future policy with regard to immigration. And Stephen Miller goes much, much further than that and really defines one pole of extreme reluctance to have more immigration, legal or illegal. And so those voices, when you hear Sarah Sanders say that there's been a lot of negotiation going on in the White House, she's talking about the back and forth among people who work in the White House more than any back and forth between the White House and Capitol Hill.
Well, Ron, in a commentary you write, and we'll post it at hereandnow.org, you point out that we Americans are pretty conflicted, too. Polls show at least three and four agree that DACA, the population should have legal status to stay, but also a majority of Americans don't think DACA was worth shutting the government down over. And even though they believe that there should be a path for DACA recipients, just briefly, we are as conflicted.
The country is conflicted about immigration. The country is built on immigration. Most of us are descended from immigrants in one sense or another. But when people look forward at the immigrants who are coming today and those who will come tomorrow, sometimes they ask whether those people will be enough like themselves to have the same privileges as Americans that they enjoy. That's where we are.
Yeah, and as you write, we have to find what Lincoln called our bonds of affection. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, you're getting your news about the shutdown from NPR. If you're under 30, there's a good chance you're also getting your news about the shutdown from Snapchat. The app is very popular with young people, and it turns out it has become popular with child predators as well. Joining us now is Adam Scott Wandt, who's an assistant professor of public policy at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And how much predatory behavior are you seeing right now on Snapchat, especially versus other sites or apps?
Snapchat has become a haven for child predators to be able to both exchange child pornography with each other and to be able to induce children to send pictures of them to the predator. And we're also seeing difficulty in law enforcement being able to investigate due to the safeguards Snapchat has in deleting both snaps and stories after certain amounts of time.
Because they disappear right away within a few seconds in some cases.
Yeah, in some cases, you know, it depends. Snapchat supports different methods of communication, snaps, stories, and chats. Some disappear as soon as they're open and read. Others stay around for a day or so. Some could stay as long as 30 days. But if law enforcement doesn't know that this is going on and they don't get to Snapchat on time with a legal process to request or to preserve the evidence, they lose it forever.
So what can investigators do about that?
You know, it's really difficult. Unless an investigator is able to either get to Snapchat within 24 hours of the snap being exchanged, or unless they're able to pre-identify who the predator is and set up an operation with Snapchat where they're monitoring that offender, you know, it's extremely hard to do. We have children all over the country that are being approached by people they think are children their own age, but really they are predators. They are adults who are significantly older than them and have fake profiles to try to lure the children to send them photos that could either be nude or of them doing other things.
Is there anything parents can do to protect their children from stuff like this?
Parents are absolutely the first and most important defense in protecting their children from online predators. Parents have to be astute and educated as to what is going on in the online environment. They need to be able to monitor their children's social media account. The Megan Meyer Foundation, which looks at and studies online cyberbullying, they find that about 60% of parents check their kids' social media. 35% of parents know their children's password to social media accounts, which is important too. But ultimately, one of the problems that we see happen over and over again are children who have multiple social media accounts that their parents don't know about.
So we've talked about what investigators can do, what parents can do. What about Snapchat? Do they have any responsibility here?
You know, Snapchat is a company that has evolved a lot. When Snapchat first came out, the safeguards were absolutely horrendous, and the Federal Trade Commission got involved, the federal government got involved, and today they have many more safeguards in place. But still, one of the problems is that it is extremely easy for anyone to create a Snapchat account and lie about their age, sex, and pictures. Certain social media apps out there try to prevent against this by forcing users to link it to a Facebook account, for example. If you are forced to link an account, it would reduce the number of fake accounts out there. It makes them harder to create, but certainly not impossible.
If we were to take the word Snapchat and replace it with Facebook or something else in this conversation, are the same issues happening all over the place and we're just picking on Snapchat because of this disappearing trick that they have?
Certainly not. Snapchat is unique because of that disappearing trick, or the fact that they clear the photographs from their servers after a certain amount of time. That makes it extremely unique for investigators to have to try to deal with, and it makes it a safe haven for predators who want to be able to abuse children and exchange pictures with very little repercussions. I would think that certain things could be put in place to make it safer for children. The use of artificial intelligence and the ability to vet users as they sign up is something that's going to become much more important in the years to come. And ultimately, we should be able to solve this problem over time, but it's certainly not going to be easy.
And by the way, Snapchat also has a younger clientele than Facebook, 71% of users under the age of 34.
Correct. Snapchat has always had a younger clientele than the other social media networks. Snapchat is extremely popular with the younger elementary school and the younger high school children in society today. And percentage-wise, it's extremely interesting that more and more young people are abandoning Facebook and Instagram, which is where their parents and family are, and adopting Snapchat for their main method of social communication.
That's Adam Scott Wandt, who is an assistant professor of public policy at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Cape Town, South Africa may soon become the first major city in the world to run out of water. Cape Town is a beautiful international tourist destination with about 3.7 million people, but it's confronting the worst drought in a century, and there's fear that all taps will have to be turned off on April 21st. In the meantime, city leaders are slashing the amount of water residents can now use every day. Joining us, the BBC's Phumza Philjani in Johannesburg. And Phumza, this has gotten punitive. The mayor accused residents of callously using more than the 87 liters, about 23 gallons, they had been allotted every day. She sounded very angry.
She has come out very strongly, Robin, criticizing residents for what she says is being selfish. She said they haven't done enough to adhere to the recommendations. They've now slashed that figure, which was initially given, of how much water people would be allowed to use per person, per household, to 50 litres. Now, that means two large buckets of water per person, no more and no less. And for the people in Cape Town, that seems like a drastic measure.
Well, you use up about two-thirds of that 50 litres with a shower and flushing a toilet. So, you know, people are being asked to do things like what? Save bath water, save shower water for other uses?
So one of the main measures has been reducing the amount of time people spend in the shower. And for people that are used to the luxury that Cape Town promises, this has come across as a rather drastic measure. So they're talking about timed two-minute showers, people reusing some of the water that they've used in other areas and finding other uses for it around the household. This means limiting the amount of water you drink, limiting the showers that you take, and turning off appliances, rather like the dishwashing machine, and rather opting for hand washers.
So no washing machines, no dishwashers, a ban on washing cars or filling swimming pools, and use your gray water to flush the toilet, you know, pour it down the toilet. This is quite something. Is it the drought, which is significant? Is it also the larger population?
Well, some people have said it's a bit of both, Robin. They found that, firstly, Cape Town has been trying to get on top of a three-year-long drought. They've been trying to recover from the effects of that. And some experts have pinned this down to climate change. But on the other hand, other experts have criticized the city's town planners. They have said that they simply have not done enough over the years to anticipate the population growth there. Now, we're talking about a city that's sitting with about nearly 4 million people, and that's one of the largest cities here in South Africa, that not enough dams have been built over the time that the population has grown and infrastructure has remained the same. And that's why the city now finds itself in this position that it's in.
Yeah, the drought was caused by the El Nino weather phenomenon that we've been talking so much about. So perhaps the taps are turned off in April. What is the city doing to get ready?
That is a question that the officials have been very sort of difficult to pin down on exact details, but we have a vague idea of what they're talking of doing. There are a number of projects that are underway. One, they are looking at desalination, which is basically looking at ways of converting the seawater into drinkable water. They've got a few plants down in Cape Town at the moment that are currently trialing this. They're trying to remove the sea salt from ocean water to make it drinkable. They are also looking at drilling aquifers, which is a vast deposit of water permeable rock throughout the Western Cape region, and drilling for water that can be used in households or different parts of the city centre. So that's another solution. But of course, the big problem at the moment that they're finding themselves in is that a number of these projects need money, and it's not clear that the city will have enough time to raise the money that they need to fund these rather ambitious projects. So when the TERPs turn off, they're talking to residents about going to various sites. These are public water taps dotted across the city to collect water in buckets. So picture it, if you will, the iconic Table Mountain in the background and people leaning over taps in long queues trying to collect water with water bottles and plastic buckets.
We have to remember Cape Town, a huge tourist destination. So this is really going to hit the city's economy. We'll keep an eye on this. The BBC's Phumza Vishani in South Africa. Phumza, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, staying in Africa, what did those comments from President Trump about African countries, Haiti and El Salvador, you know the ones I'm talking about, do to America's image on the continent? Trump has denied using the derogatory language he's reported to have used, but some worry that the damage from those reported remarks has already been done. For more, we're joined by Ismail Inache, a British Somali journalist. He joins us on Skype from The Gambia in West Africa. Ismail, welcome.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
And you wrote a piece for NPR's Parallels page, which we'll link to at hereandnow.org. And you say the anger over Trump's comments was palpable in West Africa. What have you heard from people there?
Well, when President Trump made his comments, many were shocked and frankly disgusted that the president or the United States can describe entire countries and cultures with such disparaging comments. And many people felt that was wrong, but also they felt Mr. Trump clearly misunderstood or is not interested in the complexity and the realities for people in this continent.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is previous United States presidents such as Barack Obama and George W. Bush have been hugely popular in the continent. They've taken interest in terms of their policy positions, but also they've taken interest recognizing the long historical connection between the United States and Africa. And of course, I have to add at this point, you know, a few weeks ago, I was in Senegal, in Dakar, and I went to Gorée Island, where many enslaved Africans were sent in chains across the Atlantic to the New World, where they were taken to plantations, and many of them were subjugated to horrendous, sort of terror. And that history and that legacy is painfully still in the minds of many Africans. And American presidents historically have taken a cue from that history, and they have treated people on this continent with dignity and respect. And that is something that President Trump has not at all given to the people in this continent. And I think what you saw after his comments was an avalanche of criticism, both from leaders, but from ordinary Africans who felt repelled, who said, how can this president of the United States be so ignorant of history?
Well, and you say that as a result of comments like this, that China is stepping into the vacuum created by President Trump in Africa and almost everywhere else. Tell us the specifics there. What are you talking about?
Well, what I'm talking about is the comments obviously drew a lot of criticism and anger, rightly. What has been missed is the deeper strategic shift that's going on in Africa towards China. Over the last two decades, 1 million Chinese have arrived in the continent. China is investing huge amounts of money. They are engaged in mammoth infrastructure projects. They're building roads, they're building dams, they're building highways, they are building trains. So I went to, in Dakar, I went to the Confucius Institute, which has propagated not just across Africa, but across the world. And China really is stealing a march on the US and on other nations. And frankly, what comments that Trump is alleged to have made last week do is send a very clear message to African nations that going forward, China is a country that not only will fund, but also will not disparage and insult.
Do the people in Africa have any skepticism, though, about China and its desires in Africa?
I think so. And I think, of course, while I talk about the fact that Trump's comments have created this kind of opportunity for China, and the fact that Trump's comments will nudge African nations towards China, I think it's also very important for your listeners to remember that, you know, there has been a lot of controversy with the presence of China. We've seen, for example, protests in Zambia, where people have taken to the streets because of the Chinese presence. We have seen protests in other parts of Africa. And of course, some of the business and bilateral and other kind of agreements that China has agreed to with African nations have often been to the benefit of China at the expense of African nations. And some worry, for example, China coming in and taking resources out, whether it's coal, whether it's minerals or oil, there's obviously a colonial tinge, I would say, to the relationship between China and Africa today.
You're from Somalia. How do you personally feel when you heard about the president's comments?
I felt deeply hurt by those comments because I think it goes to a deeper narrative that has unfortunately stuck around for a very long time about Africa, which frames this place, this continent of nations and peoples and cultures as an undesirable continent, as a place of wars, famines, and disease. Unfortunately, I think it also shows the level of regard that your government has towards us. And I don't think that's a good omen for future relationships between Africa and America. And finally, just to add, Jeremy, that it's not just on this front in terms of the comments he's made. You must also remember the travel ban, which had applied to people who are of Somali background. And I was actually in the United States last year when the travel ban was brought in under President Trump. And as a dual British Somali citizen, the ban had actually initially applied to me, you know, and I was stuck in the US, unable to leave because I had to come back to the US. And, you know, those were panic days that I spent in New York. And that was a direct result of President Trump's Muslim travel ban. And, you know, that has left a bitter taste in many of our mouths. And I think that is deeply unfortunate because clearly Trump, you know, was elected and that must be respected. But, you know, to my mind, he doesn't represent the many Americans that I know who don't value what he values. But unfortunately, he is creating a cascade of chaos across the world with his policies, with his tweets, with his comments. And I think that's dangerous for the U.S. long term.
That's Ismail Inache, who is a freelance journalist joining us from The Gambia in West Africa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of Ask Me Another. We headed out to L.A. for two all-celebrity contestant shows, and the competition was more intense than the traffic on the 405. Linda Cardellini, Jeff Garland, Lance Reddick, and Paul Rust. Only one took home an Ask Me Another Rubik's Cube. Find Ask Me Another on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
In addition to punishment, prison time can also be about rehabilitation, as it is for a group of women inmates in Tennessee who just graduated from Lipscomb University, a private liberal arts college. Julieta Martinelli from member station WPLN attended their ceremony.
In many ways, this feels like any graduation. Bright purple curtains with Lipscomb University's logo adorn a stage in a gym. Graduates in black caps and gowns chat excitedly. But it's not quite the same. Their family and friends wait in line to go through a security check. They stand barefoot while their shoes and items are passed through a scanner. They can't bring in balloons or flowers or even a camera to record the special moment. But for the graduates, it won't matter. They're proud of their education.
The first degree I earned in 2013 was an associate's degree, and now a Lipscomb graduate with a bachelor's degree.
That's Donna, almost 60 years old. She walks with a cane due to health issues. We're not using her last name because the Department of Correction didn't give permission. Donna is serving a life sentence for murder. She has spent close to two decades behind bars and will likely spend the rest of her life here.
You have to remember, I'm a criminal. A lot of people in society, that's all they'll remember.
First, there was a prison book club and then an associate's program. There was no plan for bachelor degrees in prison, but Richard Good, a Lipscomb history professor and the program's founder, believed the women could go further. So he started the program in 2007.
We could have never imagined that it would reach this level. You know, we've seen the program grow over the years, but really the growth is measured in the students themselves.
Though higher education initiatives were once prevalent in prisons, Lipscomb's bachelor program is now one of only a handful in the U.S. Most lost funding in 1994 when inmates were blocked from receiving Pell Grants. Those that remained were mostly privately funded. An Obama-era pilot program, which set aside just 1% of the Pell Grant budget for prisoners, is now in its second year, though its future is still uncertain. A 2013 RAND study found that inmates who received any type of education were 43% less likely to return to prison. Bianca Van Hadorn is director of educational initiatives at John Jay College's Prisoner Reentry Institute in New York. She says inmates who have access to education are more likely to find work and less likely to reoffend, because education does more than give them something to do.
We paint people as criminals, and that's all they'll ever be. One of the most powerful things is about the change in perception. One thing that higher ed does is help to produce an identity shift from inmate or criminal to that of student and thinker.
Back at the Tennessee Prison for Women, the graduates on average score higher than the university's traditional students. And that's without access to the internet and with only 3 hours of instruction once a week. A four-year degree can take more than 10 years in here. But Donna says time is the one thing she has.
It doesn't matter that the state says I'll be here till I die. There are people who won't. And if nobody's here to show them the right way in which to go, they'll keep coming back here.
Donna says she'd like to get her master's next, if that ever becomes available, and hopes to become a prison counselor. Her goal? To keep young women from coming back. She'll never be able to put her past behind her, and the family she hurt won't either. But she says at least she can try and keep others from making the same mistake as she did. For Here and Now, I'm Julieta Martinelli in Nashville.
Norwich, Vermont has about 3,400 residents, so it's not the biggest town, unless you're talking winter sports, and then Norwich is huge. Since 1984, this town has sent an athlete to every Winter Olympics save one. There's gold medal mogul skier Hannah Carney, the ski jumpers Mike Holland and Jeff Hastings. Norwich has summer Olympians as well, including runner Andrew Weeding. So are they holding training sessions from birth or putting babies on the skis before they can walk? Far from it, according to New York Times sports reporter Karen Krause. In her new book, Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town's Secret to Happiness and Excellence, she writes about this small town's unconventional and perhaps instructive approach. Karen Krause, welcome.
Thank you.
How would you sum it up?
It's a culture built around multiple sports, no-cut leagues, community, sportsmanship, all of the things that you think you can't have and also churn out athletes at the most proficient level. And yet this town, because of all of those characteristics, has managed to do it.
Well, and it also, in this formula, includes parents who seem almost clueless about their children's
right.
capabilities. I mean, there's a story of many parents who are approached by coaches or people even from outside the state who say, you know, your child could be an Olympian. And they're like, really?
Yes, Andrew Weeding discovered running quite late. He was a senior in high school when he ran his first track race, and his mother had to look up a regional competition, the footlocker competition, which is really quite well known. But she had heard other parents talking about it and thought, maybe I should look that up and see if Andrew could participate in that. I had ski jumpers, the Hollands. Mrs. Holland told me she is deathly afraid of heights. And so she would watch her sons compete and applaud loudly if they just made it to the bottom of the hill standing up.
Well, and it's a region where kids had tow lines in backyards, and
yes.
This is what everybody did after school on the West Coast. You might have gone surfing, and maybe you take out horses in the West itself, but in Vermont, you know, you just put on skis. But that's the point. It was play. And you talk about Hannah Carney, the mogul skier. She also rode horses, ran track, played soccer. did whatever she wanted. I mean, as I was reading this, I'm thinking, no, that can't be. I mean, because any parent would be forgiven for if they see a spark in a child wanting to blow on that ember, wanting to get private lessons and let's send you across the country on a junior's tour or something. Really? They don't do that.
What the Norwich athletes found almost by accident is that by changing sports with the seasons, what they were doing is working different muscle groups. They were developing this overall sense of how their body moves. The best example I can give of that is Andrew Weeding. He was a basketball player in high school, and he really didn't like the other players elbowing him. He took it quite personally, he said. And yet, when he turned his attention to track, what he found is that when he was in a pack, he knew how to react. He knew how to get space because he had been doing that on the basketball court, and that was a skill that easily transferred onto the track.
Yeah. Well, and there's not a lot of wealth in this town. Hannah Carney was told by her parents, hey, if you want to continue with this, you got to raise your own money to do
right.
it.
I love that story because Hannah wrote up a resume and went on her bike and visited different community businesses and got a little bit of money that way. And then there was a man who was the father of one of the parents in town who heard about Hannah's situation, and he agreed to sponsor her. And all he asked in return is that she provide her report card to him every term, and also that she provide him with a detailed budget of how she spent every dollar that he gave her. How great is that? Here was Hannah, barely a teenager, and she was learning, A, the value of money, and B, education was the most important thing.
Well, and you begin the book with perhaps a cautionary tale from Norwich, because their earliest winter athletes, skiers Betsy and Sunny Snite, children of Al, who pushed his daughters so to succeed, it was sort of a lesson in how not to bring up athletes. They were pushed, they were dominated by their father, and you found them decades later kind of sad.
And I've seen this, Robin, time and again. I've been covering sports and the Olympic sports for over 30 years. Athletes for whom their sport is their entire identity and who maybe were doing the sport for reasons other than their own passion. Yeah. They were doing it to please someone. They were doing it to get attention. And it's a really tough transition when that sport is no longer a part of your life, redefining yourself when no one has ever let you know that you are part of something bigger than yourself or that you have other talents or gifts.
So the story of the Snite girls is a sad one, but maybe it informed the town because now you have athletes like Hannah Carney. When she didn't do as well as she wanted in one of the Olympics, she came back to a hero's welcome. Or you have snowboarder Kevin Pierce, who everyone thought was going to be an Olympian. He was on his way to take on Shaun White and challenge him in the Olympics when Kevin Pierce suffered that terrible fall and massive brain trauma. The town embraced him as much as they did their gold medal winners.
Yes, and it's funny, maybe people who are so concentrated on the end result, winning, may think that his story is a sad one, but I actually felt it was in many ways the most uplifting story in the book because he is the first to admit that he is not only a better person for what he went through, but he is also impacting more people than he ever might have as an Olympic medalist. He has started a foundation, Love Your Brain, that works with those who have suffered traumatic brain injuries and their caregivers. And he attributes his ability to rebound directly to how he was raised, that because he was given so much freedom and independence, he developed resilience because he had to pick himself up, often quite literally, from these falls. And that enabled him to get through one of the worst falls you can ever imagine experiencing.
The town's embrace is pretty incredible. There's a send-off for each of the athletes that goes to the Olympics. Yes. They get things like a bottle of local water from the Dan and Witt store, because, of course, there's got to be something in the water, which is what people say. They get a bag of screams. There's like a plastic bag and everybody screams in it.
They're cheers, Robin, cheers. A bag of cheers.
As we said, they get parades when they come home, no matter how they did. And it's amazing how many athletes stay. And so they then are maybe coaching somebody on the rope toe, you know, down the road. But do you worry that in writing this book, this is going to be read by that different kind of parent somewhere in the country saying, we have to move to Norwich because that's what we need to do to get our child to the Olympics, and it's going to change Norwich?
I'm hoping that the opposite will happen, in that every community will try to replicate Norwich within its own borders. Norwich doesn't have a secret sauce that is unattainable elsewhere. Again, it's just a culture that is built around multiple sports,
no cut team leagues.
I mean, yeah. It's not just the fact that you're allowing anyone to participate. The best players on those no-cut teams are being sent a message that it isn't all about proficiency. It's about working together. It's about having empathy for those who aren't as good as you. Hannah said that she met girls in her kindergarten through sixth grade rec league teams that she would have never crossed paths with otherwise. They were girls who were in these sports mostly for the social piece of it. In any other circumstance, they might have been left on the sidelines. Instead, they became, for Hannah, some of her closest friends, and they really provided a balance for her when she was so self-involved in this Olympic piece and thinking that every loss was a disaster. And they were able to lend her the perspective that kept her in the proper frame of mind.
That's Karen Krause. Her new book is Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town's Secret to Happiness and Excellence. Karen, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Four new flavors of Diet Coke go on sale this week. There is ginger lime, twisted mango, zesty blood orange, and feisty cherry. It's part of an effort to improve slumping sales. According to Beverage Digest, the amount of Diet Coke sold in the U.S. has fallen every year since 2006. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does each Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
And you write that this is Diet Coke's moment of panic.
Yes, it is. I mean, Diet Coke might be the second most popular soda still in the country, but its sales have been declining every single year for the last decade. And my theory here is that its jobs have essentially been outsourced to other beverages. Let's take three jobs of Diet Coke: hydration, energy, and fizz. Well, hydration has been outsourced to bottled water.
Right.
Bottled water consumption is going way up. Energy has been outsourced, I think, to the energy drinks, to Gatorade, and even to coffee. The U.S. coffee industry is actually on pace to surpass soda sometime in the 2020s, which is something unthinkable 10, 15 years ago. And then finally, you have fizz, that sort of delightful feeling that some people enjoy in carbonated beverages. But even as soda sales are slumping, flavored seltzer is on fire between sparkling ice, LaCroix, Perrier, San Pellegrino. That entire category is growing by double-digit percentage points. So essentially, to sum up, I just think that everything that people wanted out of Diet Coke up till, say, 2000, 2005, has essentially just been outsourced to other beverages that seem to be doing the same thing better.
But it sounds like you're also saying this is not necessarily a Diet Coke problem. This is just a soda problem. People are moving, as you say, towards bottled water largely.
Yes, that's exactly it. I mean, at the peak of soft drink consumption in the U.S. in the mid-2000s, Americans drank 53 gallons of soda per person each year. That is more than half a liter per person every single day. It's just absurd how much soda we have been drinking in this country. And what's been happening is that you have essentially a health wave that's come up against our fascination with soda. There's a growing consumer focus, I think, on health that has hurt soda's domination. You have concerns often buffeted by government data that daily drinkers of diet soda are at higher risk for various maladies, including stroke, strokes and other, quote, vascular events. So in many ways, sort of the diet in diet soda used to be an attractor. You drank this because you wanted to be thin. But now the concept of a diet cola seems paradoxical and wrong, I think, to a lot of today's drinkers. And as a result, you do have this enormous shift away from soda toward things like, as you said, bottled water consumption, which has tripled this century.
Yeah, certainly a healthier alternative. At the same time, you've still got the same problem with us producing and using a ton of plastic bottles for 5 minutes and then throwing them out.
Right. I mean, I will say briefly that I do not happen to drink that much bottled water for precisely this reason. I feel like I might as well just turn on the tap and have some of New York's finest in a mug rather than buy some from Evian or Dasani. That said, it seems like most Americans disagree with me because bottled water consumption is absolutely on fire. And as I said, it is surpassing now total consumption of soda for the first time ever.
You also write about a different beverage. And you paint a much rosier picture, and that is craft beer. What did you find about the craft beer industry in this country?
So it's interesting. I was researching something completely different, totally, totally far away from the world of beverages, which is monopolies in America. And Anheuser-Busch InBev and Miller Coors, the two largest beer producers in the U.S., as recently as 2012, actually controlled about 90% of beer production in this country. But then I saw a statistic that just knocked me off my chair. And that was that between 2008 and 2016, the number of brewery establishments grew by a factor of 6. And the number of workers in these breweries more than doubled in less than a decade. I mean, that is just a remarkable period of growth for a 200-year-old industry. And the reason essentially is, as you said, that craft beer is ascendant. And it's ascendant really for three quick reasons. First, consumer tastes have changed. We like hops a lot more than we used to, and Budweiser isn't famous for meeting that taste. Two, beer manufacturing equipment has gotten a lot cheaper, so it's easier for a handful of people to sort of brew in their basement in the garage. And then three, there's a very specific regulatory regime that I won't go into in too much depth that essentially makes it a lot easier for upstarts in beer as opposed to upstarts in a lot of other industries where you tend to see monopolies dominate.
Well, and just briefly, what does this mean for the big beer companies? Are they going to just buy up the craft brewers, or what do you expect?
I think they're going to try, absolutely. I mean, they already have tried. You know, Goose Island, which is one of my favorite breweries, which is out of Chicago, where I went to school, has already been bought by the conglomerates. And I think they're going to try to do the same and even try to monopolize the beer manufacturing equipment sort of level of this industry to sort of, you know, own the means by which these craft producers are making beer, even if they can't own the beer itself. So, yes, you are going to see an attempt for the monopolies to take over. But right now, let's celebrate good news where we can find it. Craft beer is ascendant,
Doing well.
It is fantastic for beer jobs.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, music courtesy of APM. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.